Well, with all those qualifications, I should add one additional one, and that is that I might be crazy. I might be crazy because I'm not sure I can do this. I'm not sure I can talk and try to give an introduction, a coherent introduction to Buddhism in 1 hour, let alone do it without using all those wonderful foreign words and technical terms we Buddhists love to throw around. But I'm going to try, and we will see whether or not this can be done or not. You are the guinea pigs, as it were. I want to try it because it seems to me that if Buddhism is accessible to the West, and I firmly believe it is, we ought to be able to talk about it in plain language, in our own language. So it's worth a try to do that. However, in order to do this, obviously I'm going to have to paint with a very, very broad brush. Introduction to Buddhism in 1 hour. Right, you can teach an entire seminar on that for a semester at a university and just barely get through it. So my apologies for the broad brush, because that means I am going to grossly oversimplify things. And oversimplification essentially means distortion. So to the Buddhists present, my apologies, I am going to distort Buddhism to some degree. I'm going to try not to, but inevitably I'm going to. And to the non-Buddhists present, I'm going to do even worse for you. Because, for purposes of comparison, I'm going to say one or two little words here and there about some other faiths and ways of seeking meaning and truth. And I'm only going to spend 2 or 3 seconds on those, so I'm going to have to paint with a brush that's the size of a barn sign. Okay? And my apologies for the oversimplification and distortion there, even more. There are many forms of Buddhism, and while I'm going to try to keep this talk general, obviously I'm going to come at it from my own experience, my own biases, and those are from one of the Zen forms of Buddhism. So what you will hear, although I'm going to try to make it general, won't be entirely general. I'll do the best I can. And any religion that's been around as long as this has, 2,500 and some years, has developed lots of different branches and different ways of proceeding. So just about anything that I could say will be disagreed with, and legitimately so, by some fellow Buddhist. So in the end, I guess what I'm going to have to say is, I'll try to be general, I'll try to be generic, but in the end I'm talking about what I myself believe, okay, or what I myself have found. That's about all I, in the end, can do. In the process of doing that, I will talk perhaps somewhat enthusiastically. That's because the stuff works for me. That's because I believe the stuff. But don't please interpret my enthusiasm as an attempt to convince you or anyone else. We're in this for information sharing here, not for converting anyone. So my enthusiasm should please be interpreted in that way. I believe it. I'm enthusiastic about it. I'm excited about it. But I'm really simply trying to inform, not to persuade. Now, the idea for a talk like this actually first came to me several years ago when I heard the words to a country and western song. I suppose I should explain what a Zen monk is doing listening to country and western. I sometimes have to do some long-distance driving, and sometimes I do that alone. And after lunch, I sometimes will turn on the car radio to give myself a sort of jolt of musical caffeine, keep myself awake through the digestion period. So I was in the Central Valley somewhere, listening to this country and western station, keeping myself awake. And they had one of these songs that's sort of partly humorous and partly philosophical that they come up with every once in a while. And in this song, the young cowpoke is asking the old-timer about the meaning of life. And he asks them a number of different deep questions, which I have totally forgotten. And no matter what he asks them about the meaning of life, the old-timer comes back with the same response. He says, faster horses, younger lovers, More money. And I thought, well, a little bit crude, but by golly, it puts its finger on something about the human condition. And what it puts its finger on is that we're never satisfied. If we haven't got it, we want it. And if we've got it, we want more of it. And if we've got lots, we're afraid of losing it, whatever it may be. And so our lives are ruled, either subtly or grossly, or both, by cycles of greed and fear. And because of that, it is very difficult to find peace. It is very difficult to be in harmony with ourselves, with each other, and with the world. And in quiet, reflective moments, we kind of know that. We sense that. There is a dis-ease. There is a suspicion that somehow there must be more to it than faster horses. And so, in various ways, we seek truth. We seek meaning. We seek harmony. And there are various ways of doing that, of which Buddhism is one among many. What are some of these ways? Well, I would say that perhaps the most usual way is simply to immerse oneself in the cycle of greed and fear. Join the rat race, get all you can, and distract yourself at all costs from those quiet, reflective moments where you start to realize there might be something wrong with this. And so, the music blares all day. TV or the video game is on for 6 hours a day. We lose ourselves in the internet. We get drunk. We get high. You name it. We distract ourselves. This may be a rather usual approach, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work because the awareness of the dissatisfactoriness of this seeps in around the edges. As much as we may try to distract ourselves, you can't fully do it. And particularly when we're in our teenage and young adult years, and again when we're older, particularly in those times, we tend to think about the meaning of life, and we tend to be less able to distract ourselves. And so the rat race ultimately doesn't work. Well, if joining the rat race is not sufficient for someone, what are some of the other possibilities? Well, one of the other possibilities is to seek meaning, truth, etc., through various secular philosophies. And I'm now going to butcher all of philosophy in 2 minutes. There are two kinds of philosophy. All right. We have the atheist philosophies and the agnostic philosophies, is how I'm going to classify them. By the atheist philosophies, I mean things that end up concluding something like, yes, it is all meaningless. Or, God is dead and religion is either the opium of the masses or the universal obsessional neurosis, depending on whether you want Freud or Marx. The other way around, Marx or Freud. And many variants thereof. Now, as opposed to simply trying to distract oneself, this has the virtue of really looking at them. It is honest. I must admit, in my own very limited experience, I haven't seen it work that often, in that the folks I have met who have been seriously committed to these types of philosophies have never impressed me as being very happy people, or very peaceful, or very much in harmony with things. Now, I may not have met the right Marxists, Freudians, or existentialists, but that has been my impression. It may work for some people. Obviously, for some, it doesn't. It certainly didn't work for me, though I did try it. And my problem with it was, well, how can you know for sure, how can you assert for sure that God does not exist unless you knew everything? I mean, he's out there somewhere, right? I mean, it might be. So how can you say for sure there is no God unless you knew everything? If you knew everything, you'd be omniscient. If you were omniscient, you'd be God. I could never get my head around that one, so it didn't work for me. Then we have what I'm choosing to call the agnostic philosophies, the ones which say, hey, I don't know about this stuff, but I do know this, we've got each other, and let's do right by one another. In other words, humanism of various sorts. And this seems to work. The people I've met who do this seem to be kinder and gentler and happier and more ethical. And some people find this works fully satisfactorily. And like all of these things, it works for some and doesn't for others. For the ones it doesn't work for, there seems to be a nagging sense there's more to it than this. And that sense just doesn't leave them alone, which again was my situation. So we turn to other things. Look again, those of us that doesn't work for. One of the obvious places to look is to religion. And the majority of the religious traditions of the world, here's where I'm going to butcher the other great religions of the world, and say that they are basically founded on faith, belief, and worship. Certainly the religion from which the Buddha himself originated, as I said, lived some 2,500 years ago. He was brought up in the Hindu faith, one of the current, vibrant, still great religions of the world. And in a sense, that way Buddhism grew out of Hinduism in a way that's a little bit, not totally, a little bit analogous to the way in which both Christianity and Islam came from the foundations of Judaism. Now, if you oversimplify in this way and look at these religions as religions primarily of faith, primarily of belief, then it is clear that they work. And it is clear that they work for those of us who can make that leap of faith, for those of us who can find within themselves that belief. And if one can, then peace and truth and meaning do arise, and one does become more ethical. And one finds that there are viable codes of morality that one can follow. And it satisfies. And again, it doesn't satisfy for everyone. There are some of us who seem unable to make that leap of faith, who seem, for one reason or another, unable to believe in the way that makes these religions work. I myself, again, was one of those. I was brought up in a Protestant church, and things were going along reasonably well until I became a middle teenager, and we had a youth group, and we were meeting with the minister, and we were a fairly bright-eyed, bushy-tailed bunch of youngsters, and started asking the wrong questions. And we started pinning our poor old minister to the wall with things like, well, how do you know the Bible is the Word of God? Or, how do we know that God exists? Or, is there some way of knowing that God really is a Trinity, etc.? And eventually, he was an older gentleman, unfortunately. Eventually, we pinned him down to the point where he said, look, kids, either you believe this stuff or you don't. And if you don't believe it, there's not really much point in us continuing with this. We sort of looked at each other and we said, right. That was the end of the youth group. Oh dear, now I have since realized, being in the religion business, that didn't have to happen. That didn't have to happen. If he had known more about how to relate to young people, he would have seen that as an invitation to a serious Christian dialogue. And we could have gone some very interesting places from there. But so be it, it didn't happen in this case. And so I and a bunch of others were sort of thrown off into we knew not where, looking for something. So for some people it doesn't work because they somehow can't give that belief or faith. For others, perhaps it doesn't work because the belief or faith is partial or imperfect. And if one knows that one's faith is partial or imperfect, that can be quite productive because it leads one further on. The nagging questions that come up lead one deeper. if one doesn't know that one's faith is imperfect or partial, then, and yet it is, then it can get into difficulties in the sense that sometimes we become intolerant of others, sometimes we try to sort of bolster our own faith by trying to go out there and force other people to believe the same thing, and we all know the history of humankind where that has led to, still is leading to, as our friend gave examples just now about Ireland and Kosovo. All right. Well, suppose you were one, as I was, as the Buddha, a number of folks have been, for which these approaches somehow don't work. Numbers 1 through 3. There's another one that can be tried. It's not very popular these days, but it was in the Buddha's time, and it goes in and out of popularity. It's called asceticism. And it's actually quite logical. I mean, if the problem is that we are attached to greed and trying to attach to pleasure and trying to run from pain, attached to greed, fear, then the obvious solution is, okay, let's go towards pain and away from pleasure. It's logical, but it doesn't work. It seems that you can induce religious experiences that way, but at least from my experience and what I've read, they just don't seem to go anywhere too much. It's not very popular because, of course, it's not much fun. And those folks that I've known that have seemed to really try to do that to a great degree end up with what I somewhat irreverently call the pitted prune syndrome, i.e. their spiritual life is sort of all shriveled up and wrinkled and dry and kind of sour, which seems to be a consequence of the ascetic way of going about things. And there doesn't seem to be a whole great deal of peace or harmony. Okay, well, that's another one down. There's a fifth option. There's probably lots more, too, I just haven't thought of. This was the option that the Shakyamuni Buddha, historical Buddha, took, and on which Buddhism itself is founded. And it's really quite simple. It's that one suspects, okay, if those quiet, still moments that got us into trouble in the first place, i.e. made us aware somehow that faster horses is not fully what life is about, what if we had more of those quiet, still moments? They've shown us the problem. Is it possible they will show the solution as well? So that's what the Buddha did. He returned to a very simple practice that he and many of us actually stumble on in our youth, which is simply being quiet, still, and aware. And by cutting out sitting underneath, as you would, discursive thoughts, beliefs, judgments, emotional attachments, all the stuff we normally occupy our minds with, something did indeed become apparent, and does still today become apparent. The first thing that becomes apparent is that what we suspected in the beginning really is true, i.e. that greed and fear cannot lead to peace and truth and harmony and meaning. There is more to it than that. And why can't they? Why is that not going to work, the life of attachment to greeds and fears? Well, what becomes apparent is that it's not going to work because those things can never be fully satisfied. And why is that? Well, they can't be fully satisfied because of a fundamental property of the universe. And that property of the universe is that nothing stays put. Everything is always in motion, always changing. You can see that in small things. You can see that in yourself. Your body is continually changing. You're aging. You're shedding cells at every moment. Your mind is continually changing. You are not exactly in the same state of mind you were when I started this sentence. And the next component of thought is different from that, and different from that, and so on. This piece of paper, if you look at it closely enough, is changing. The acids that were used in its production are gradually eating away at it. The ink is oxidizing, some of the chemicals are outgassing, etc. It is effectively slowly disintegrating before our very eyes. And if we are to believe what our scientist friends tell us, if you have the right instruments and you look at most anything, be it the tiniest of things, or galaxies themselves, or even the nature of space and time, it's constantly changing. That being the case, greed and fear guarantee their own frustration and failure, because they're trying to hold on to something. They're trying to grasp onto and make permanent, or make part of me, something, or make stable something in a universe that is inherently unstable, that is inherently always changing, always flowing. So that is part, is one of the crucial problems with the way of life of faster horses. It's doomed to failure. Okay, now if change itself is a fundamental property of the universe, we can't do anything about that. So what can we do about it? Well, the thing we can do something about is the other side of it. You can't do anything about the fact that things change. What you can do about something about is the fact that you can change your desires and expectations. You can, for instance, give up your attachments to things. You can give up the greeds and the fears. You can let go. You can let go of everything. And simply become one with the flow of change itself. I mean, if that's the only thing that's guaranteed, why not simply try to become one with that in and of itself and see where that goes? Because if there's no grasping on, if there's no desire, if there's no clutching, then there can be no frustration of that. And therefore, there's no reason for disturbance. If there's nothing to hold on to, or nothing is held onto, then there's no reason for fear. It can't be taken away. The problem with fear is you're afraid that it's going to be taken away, or bad things are going to happen. If you're simply at one with the flow of change of the universe, then what comes, comes. And what goes, goes. So there's no basis for fear. There's no basis for judgment. There's no basis for hatred. It becomes, in the end, an alternate way of apprehending truth. By letting go of all these mental constructs, images, etc., and simply experiencing the world directly within this flow of impermanence and change. And if one does that, it leads to some very interesting and fairly radical conclusions or consequences. One of them it leads to is that things don't exist. I told you this is radical. But follow me for a moment. A thing, we all know what a thing is. A thing is something we do with our head to describe an aspect of this flow, of this change. That isn't a piece of paper, silly. Well, is it? Okay, we just looked at the fact that it's constantly changing. So how do we clearly and closely and absolutely define its parameters? The more closely and clearly we look, the less we can actually define the parameters of, quote, a piece of paper. Now, thinking in terms of things is very handy. It is an approximation. If you look at it in this way, okay, this to say that this is a piece of paper is an approximation. But it's a very handy approximation. And why do we do it? Well, I think probably we do it because in the history of not just humankind, but in the history of probably even primates before humans, but who knows, it works. These types of approximations have survival value. And to use my favorite example, if there's an orange and black visual stimulus that is getting larger in my visual fields, it is very adaptive to think there is a tiger coming down the road towards me. Get into the trees, kid. Okay. Thinking in terms of things is what allows us to cross the street without getting squished by a bus. It's very, very handy. It's a great approximation. But most of the time, thank goodness, most of us are not about to be eaten by tigers, and so we have the luxury of being able to perhaps set that way of thinking aside. Not destroy it entirely, but set it aside at particular times and see if we can look a bit in a different way that is not related to thinking in terms of things. Now, that's radical enough, but what about you and me as things? I, in a sense, am just another mental cognition. I am a thing. And my reality, we won't talk about yours, my reality is just as unlikely to be stable as the piece of paper or the tiger or anything else. In other words, looked at from this point of view, from this direct apprehending of truth without discursive thinking about it, I don't exist. I am one more approximation. Again, a very handy approximation. Folks who grow up unable to make that approximation, usually we have to take care of them for the rest of their lives. They can't cross the street without getting hit by a bus. And unfortunately, some folks have that situation. Handy approximation, me, but perhaps ultimately not true. And if I am an approximation and you are an approximation and we are all in on a deeper level of reality, simply part of this flow of this ever-changing universe, then there's really no total separation between me and you. The separation that we perceive occurs because of these handy approximations. We are all, in a sense, part of the same flow of being, time, existence. Okay, well, let's push it one more step. If there's no thing and there's no me, is there a soul? Dope. Well, in Buddhism, the answer is no. Because for the Buddha, in this way of looking, the soul was simply an extension of the me into the infinite. And this is where he broke with Hinduism, primarily. Now that doesn't say that the concept of a soul is not a viable concept and useful and good in other religions. But in this particular religion, this way of looking at it undermines that concept, or undermines that, the reality of that being. So, no soul either in Buddhism. No self, no soul, no things. This makes it a fairly scary business. Because one is dealing with going about life in a way that you try, or that in which you are trying to get rid of an I, a self, or at least are threatening to get rid of it by what you're doing, and simply living with direct experience of what is. The next thing that became apparent from just sitting quietly, alertly, calmly, was that if one wanted to do that, if one wanted to seek truth and meaning in this way, and give up attachment, and just live in this flow of the eternal now, there actually was a way of doing that. There are things one could do that would help bring that about. The first of which is to be aware of what one's doing. To be aware of oneself, to be aware of the world, to be aware of the consequences of one's own actions, of one's speech, and of one's behavior. I mean, of one's thoughts, sorry, thoughts, actions, and speech. And to be aware of the consequences of those things for oneself and for everyone else. And if you think about it for a moment, if you aren't aware of any of this stuff, you are, to use a boating analogy, dead in the water. What chance do you have of being directly aware of what is, and thereby finding truth and meaning, if you aren't aware of self, quote-unquote, self, other, and the and your actions and what you're doing and thinking and what those consequences have. So one of the focuses of the Buddhist way of going about things is to bring the mind back again and again and again to just what we're doing. Bring it back from the daydreams, the fantasies, the emotional soap operas that we play in our heads, and the endless clatter and chatter that we, or at least I, tend to fill my head with and distract myself. In fact, one of my friends here just bought me a little hamster wheel to put on my desk. It's one of my favorite analogies. You've seen a hamster in a wheel, the little wheel goes squeak, 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 and you're running and running and running. This is what I do in my head. Getting nowhere. we try to get off the hamster wheel, bring ourselves back to simple awareness of what the heck we're doing again and again and again. It's called mindfulness, and there are lots and lots of ways Buddhists have evolved over the centuries for doing that. But it's one of the things that becomes obviously necessary. Why? Why is that necessary? Okay. Well, you can see why it would be necessary in terms of being more and more aware of what we call self and other, i.e. what's out there and in there, and so forth. Why aware of thoughts? Well, because thoughts, among other things, are sort of how we shore up this superstructure that we've got in our heads about the way the world is. And I'll get back to that a little bit later. But and also that thoughts are one of the ways we sort of maintain our illusions about things, thoughts and expectations. So by being aware of them, we stand a fighting chance of being able to do something about it. Okay, why awareness of our speech and our behavior and its consequences? Well, in addition to thoughts, they shape the world we live in, the world each of us lives in. Is sort of an ongoing action and reaction from our speech and behavior. And it's what influences not only ourselves, but those around us. And it would appear, and again this is just an empirical observation, it would appear that you cannot be doing either cementing greed and fear through your actions and speech, or loosening you can't be doing that and be loosening them up at the same time. You're doing one or the other. There seems to be very little in the way of neutral ground here. There seems to be very few actions or acts of speech which don't either tend to cement this stuff in place or tend to loosen it and allow one to drop the greed and the fear. So each action, each act of speech becomes meaningful. It becomes important. Is this leading towards dropping away of greed and attachment, or is this cementing it? It's often subtly, but nonetheless real. And not just is it cementing it for me, but is it cementing it for those around me? Remember, if this way of looking at things is true, and we really are not totally separate things, then it's simple nonsense to be trying to free oneself from greed and fear and attachment at the same time that we are causing greed and fear in our next door neighbor. It's nonsense. It's just obvious nonsense because we are so intimately connected and we influence each other, and besides which it's not a you or a me, it's simply a flow being. For that reason, it became obvious to the Buddha and became part of Buddhism that it was necessary, first of all, to think clearly and courageously, when we do need to think, not when we don't need to think. but we do have to cross the street without getting hit by a bus, so we got to think sometimes. When we do need to think clearly. Because these are the guides, the maps that you create for yourself. So make them as accurate as possible. Yes, they are approximations, but make them as accurate as possible, he was saying. And for goodness sakes, don't brainwash yourself. Don't tell yourself things that aren't true. And don't tell other people things that aren't true, knowingly. I mean, we all do this to ourselves and others unknowingly. There's nothing you can do about that because you don't know you're doing it. Back to awareness again. But when you are aware, that's why you're dead in the water without awareness. When you are aware, and for goodness sakes, it's just dumb to do anything other than to cease from deliberately deluding oneself or others with one's thoughts. It obviously follows that the same goes for speech. If our thoughts are sort of our inner speech, then the same applies to our outer speech. It's simply nonsense to be trying to seek truth and meaning yourself and be willfully or deliberately misleading or harming others with speech. And again, I mean, a lot of this is just real obvious from this sort of basic premises we have here. Same true is true of actions. Why would one want to be causing harm at the same time one is trying to undo the attachments to fear oneself? To cause harm to others is simply to perpetuate the cycle of greed and fear. It's just blatant nonsense from this point of view. So you don't do it. Fortunately, there's also seems to be another one of these funny little natural laws that comes in here, and that is that for some reason, people seem to feel pain, they seem to feel dis-ease, as a consequence of harming others. I don't know why they do that. There are theories. I could spend a lovely time postulating evolutionary theories and other religious theories, but let's just leave it as an observation. It seems to hurt other beings. And this hurt, this pain consequence, seems to be inevitable. In other words, it's going to occur whether or not we recognize the linkage between our actions and harming others and this consequence. If that's true, then it's obviously better to be aware of it than not to be aware of it, because if we're aware of it, we can do something about it. If we're not, it's just one more piece of pain that we try to go finding a way around and are liable to just make do something else that causes harm in our attempt to get away from the pain of that was actually caused by our previous doing of harm. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Another thing that has been observed is that this pain seems to follow us around. And it seems to follow us around until it's fully experienced. Therefore, distracting ourselves from it just prolongs it. Again, back to awareness. And that following around in Buddhism is actually taken a little bit further than might make sense to some of us. Makes sense to me, but I've been doing this a long while. And it goes in this way. Again, it's an observation, but an observation that you can't scientifically follow. And that is that while Buddhism has no self or soul that continues on after death, it does seem to notice that some of these consequences of our actions continue after death, whether they be beneficial or harmful actions. Now, you can see that at certain levels, quite obvious, in the sense of on the social, political sphere, the war problems we were just talking about. For instance, in Kosovo, I think they're still fighting a war that started in 13-something, right? Okay. We pass these things on to future generations. We do this. If we don't set these things to rights in our own time, they get passed on through various ways of social and political and mental, however you want to do it, passing them on. Where it gets a little weird is where some people seem to find that that this happens on an individual level as well as a sort of social level, in that people seem to become aware that they seem to have tendencies or proclivities or aspects of their personality that seem, at least, to be related to perhaps unresolved harm that was caused by some other person or some other being long, long ago. And somehow they seem to feel they have an opportunity there to set that to rest through their own life and being a decent human being in this life. That's where we start using the K word, karma. It gets really weird and really complicated, so I'm not going to go into it anymore. Okay. Now, because of this observation that it is nonsense to harm others, there are, or have evolved, ethical codes, moral codes in Buddhism, to give people guidance as to how to live their lives. And there are consequences to violating those moral codes or ethical codes. But this is one of the places where Buddhism differs from many other religions. There's no lawgiver. There's no sin. There's no punishment. There are simply tragic mistakes and their natural consequences. And the codes are simply codifications. They're descriptions rather than proscriptions. They are descriptions. If you do this stuff, gang, it ain't going to be happy. Okay? Therefore, unless you're a dumb bunny, you'll try not to. It's just that simple. Okay? But it's essentially a naturalistic way of looking at it. Mistakes and their consequences. Well, another thing that becomes obvious is it doesn't make any sense to be doing this at home, and then from 9 to 5 to be going around and undoing it all. So it makes sense as to how you earn your livelihood. And the Buddhist approach to this is to try to benefit both self and others. Benefit self, as the Buddhists have no problem with making a fair profit. You got to support your family, you got to support yourself, and benefit others. And most occupations do benefit others. So mostly this is not a problem in the occupation itself, it's more a problem in how you do it. It's more a problem in what is your personal bottom line? Is it the financial bottom line, or is it something else? Perhaps doing something which is a benefit to beings, which includes making your fair profit, but in endeavoring to make a livelihood in a way that does not overly harm other beings and benefits them. Now, almost nothing we human beings do comes out clean. There are always going to be costs, there are always going to be risks, there are always going to be aspects of harm that occur with the best of intentions, doing the best of things. So it's not a question of, oh my goodness, I mustn't make a move because I might harm a being. It's, well, I'm going to do the best I can. And yes, I'm going to do some harm, and I'm going to try to minimize it. And I'm going to try to do more benefit in this world for my occupation and other things than I do harm. And if I can see a better way, I'll take it. So this business becomes essentially a total way of life. It involves one's occupation, it involves one's relationships, involves one's inner life, what one thinks, what one expects, everything. And that takes a lot of energy. So that was another thing that became obvious. Hey, this stuff takes energy, this stuff takes effort. This is not a thing easily and simply done in the sense of you can do one heroic act and that's it. This is a lifetime of doing these things, and that takes energy. It may be in accord with perceived natural laws, but you don't get there by doing what comes naturally, i.e. by drifting. Because doing what comes naturally is simply continuing what we have all been conditioned into and taught by our instincts and our culture, which is to grab for the greed and push away the fear. Okay? It's the attachment side. Now, in the long run, this approach to life does become what we might call second nature, i.e. it does get a little easier. But there is always the necessity to continue with effort and energy, because it can always deepen. And there will always be pulls to go back in the other direction. This is particularly difficult for Westerners, because we like to find quick ways of doing things. Unfortunately, so far in Buddhism, we have not found a quick way of doing things. In fact, one of the things I tell folks who ask me for quick ways is, if you look for shortcuts, you will generally find sidetracks. There are no signs, there are no portents, there are no formulas, there are no easy fixes in this. There are guides, there are intuitions, there are various other folks that can help you along, but it's not a clear-cut, obvious thing at each step of the way. There are decisions to be made, there are mistakes to be made and learned from. This is another reason why one of our other favorite Western occupations, which let's take a pill and see if we can make it happen, doesn't work. And there are people who, teachers in Buddhism tend to get grumpy when they are asked about, well, why can't we just take a drug and get a religious experience? And that'll do it. Deal with it. We get grumpy because even if the drug could induce a valid religious experience, now we're going to get into whether it can or can't. Even if it could, you got to get up and go to work tomorrow. And what you going to do? Okay? It's also why we tend to talk about not wasting time. This way of doing things will have its effects, but they're not immediate. It takes time to work. It's an entire way of life. And no one knows how much time they've got. So therefore, it makes sense not to waste it. Another thing that becomes obvious, and is related to what I just said, is that one's search for the truth, one's search for peace and meaning, needs to be uncompromising. In other words, one needs to do everything one can to have the clearest possible understanding of how it is. The enemy, if you will, in Buddhism, therefore, is not evil and not sin. It's ignorance and self-deception. And it also means that all truths, all avenues of truth, are useful. And that includes intellectual avenues of truth, which includes the things we think of as education and science. My own particular form of Buddhism, Zen, is famous for being non-intellectual. That's not because it devalues the intellect. It's because lots of us, including myself, overuse it. A little hamster wheel here. Not because there's anything wrong with it, but because it is simply one way among many of knowing, and you can get attached to that, as I well know, just like you can get attached to anything else. Mm-hmm. So it's saying, use everything. Yes, use the intellect, and use the spiritual intuition. Use empathic feeling. Use everything you've got to understand how it is to the best of your ability, to see how it is. And put nothing in your own way, deliberately, in your way or anyone else's. And finally, the thing that became obvious was it was necessary to return again and again to this quiet, still, aware place. The place that got us started in the beginning. The place that said there is something wrong with faster horses. The place from which all of this arises. And become simply aware of what is. This goes a little further than mindfulness. Remember, we started off with awareness and mindfulness, which is becoming aware of what you're doing and what is within and without. This is simply becoming aware, period. Being aware, if you will, of being. And the beingness, if you will, of everything. Not separating it out into being, into doing, into anything. Simply the quiet, still awareness. It's called meditation. There's a bazillion ways of doing it. The Buddhists have evolved and others over the centuries. But that's why one does it, one comes back to it. And that's why the Buddha himself came back to it again and again and again. He didn't just have one grand enlightenment experience and then sit back and eat chocolates. It's a lovely thought, but it doesn't work that way. He too had to get up in the morning and do something. And the living of an ethical life was just the obvious thing to do, and the coming back to this quiet place of meditation was the obvious thing to do. Because much of what goes on in the world is naturally tending to draw us in the other direction. So it makes sense to come back again and again to this source of understanding. Now, something very interesting happened when the Buddha did that. Having done that for a while, he found something totally unexpected. He set out, and Buddhists generally set out, to find peace, meaning, truth, if you will. And what he found was that at the point at which all discursive thinking stopped, at the point at which all attachments to things, all the greeds and fears, were actually let go of, at the point at which there were no more expectations, that he was simply directly aware of that which is, something else appeared. And what appeared is difficult to describe. It appeared that this flow I've been talking about of being, space, time, existence, is in and of itself utterly complete. It is totally meaningful. It is completely void of all things and at the same time totally full and totally joyous. Utterly wise and compassionate. It can be described as love itself. He used the words unborn, uncreated, undying, unformed. It is utterly benevolent. And whatever that may be, it is something in which one can place faith and belief, not ahead of time, but because one experiences it directly. And that place can be touched, however briefly, by anyone who wholeheartedly does that bunch of stuff I was just talking about. Although Shakyamuni Buddha and some others, of course, of history, have entered into it completely, many, many, many folks have touched it at least once in their lives, and often more than once. And just touching it transforms one's entire approach. And even if one never touches it directly, one can sense its presence by doing the same things we just talked about. And even the sensing of its presence is sufficient to provide peace and meaning to one's life and to deepen one's commitment to an ethical life. So that, in a nutshell,
yeah.
In an hour. That's what Buddhism is. Okay. But, like anything else, any other way of approaching truth and meaning, it's got its advantages and it's got its disadvantages. And I would be remiss not to go into some of those. It's very, very thorough. But it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of work. You only get out as much as you put in. And not everyone wants to take that much time and be that radical about things. Not everyone also is dissatisfied enough with life based on greed and fear and faster horses to make those kind of radical changes. Furthermore, if you stop part way, you sometimes end up more miserable than before you started. That sounds a little scary. Well, it is a little scary. The reason is actually quite simple. it has to do with the awareness business. If you practice awareness, you become more aware of everything. What is? That includes the fun stuff and pain. And if you get part of the way through this and decide, and lots of people do, decide, well, this isn't working, you know, I'm going to do something else. If you get a sufficient degree of awareness before that happens, you're left being more aware of your own pain. Now, you keep going, that serves as a spur to keep going deeper. If you don't, you're just in more pain. Well, actually, you aren't in more pain, you're more aware of the pain you're in. But it is a danger. And I should mention, this is also, as I said, a very radical worldview. In the end, it is very, very comforting, but it is not comforting in the beginning. Giving up this notion of a self is a scary thing, and it puts a lot of folks off. Furthermore, if you start looking at the ultimate things, the end, if you will, and try to put faith in that in the beginning, you can, and there are forms of Buddhism that are organized to do that. Difficulty is, it's not very appealing to put your faith in something which is a pure and unstained void. Whoops. Now, there are other ways of describing it that are more positive. But it still makes you a little queasy around the edges. I mean, what am I getting into? Another thing that is difficult with it is that the work of giving up attachments is hard, and the actual giving up of attachments is painful. I mean, you want it. And what you're doing is gradually releasing your clutch on things. And that is not always fun to do. That is not to say, by the way, that one ends up in a situation of there being nothing there for you. I mean, obviously, I am wearing clothing. Okay? I am not standing here in dignified nudity, which, by the way, some religion, the Jain religion, gives up everything in that way. Buddhism doesn't give up everything, it gives up the attachment to everything. Well, that's what it tries to do. I mean, you may or may not have to give up the thing. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. What you got to give up is the grabbing on. And giving up the grabbing on can be painful. There's also no guarantee. Buddhism does not offer a guarantee that you will get far enough in this life to get that sense that I spoke of, let alone touch it directly. And it places the responsibility squarely on the individual's shoulders. Yes, it has a view of the universe as utterly compassionate. And it maintains that that compassionate love of the universe has been there since forever, and you have never been apart from it. Not in the slightest bit. And it maintains that only you can realize that. And only you can do that by doing what needs to be done to bring that realization to occur. Now, to aid in some of these difficulties, many forms of Buddhism have evolved over the centuries. And they are primarily, as I see it, what differentiate the various schools of Buddhism. And there's lots of them. Lots of schools of Buddhism. These are, if you will, the add-ons to this sort of basic core. And just because I call them add-ons doesn't mean I devalue them. We are human. We are different. We need different ways in. So ceremonial has been added for some as a way of sort of meditation in action. Philosophical analysis has been added in some schools of Buddhism as a way of entry through thought and the intellect. Scriptural writings that appeal to both the intellect and to the intuition have been added. The tradition of personal teachers has been added for those who want individualized guidance. Various devotional practices have been added, which provide a way in for those who are attracted to the way of faith and belief that is in most other religions. So actually, in some forms of Buddhism, you do start there, after all. It's not that you always end up there starting from another way. There are forms of Buddhism which you start there and end up on the other side. There are, as I said, many, many aids to meditation and mindfulness. And there are many representations of aspects of this underlying truth, if you will, that have been created. That's where all the statues come from. They are representations of various aspects, representations of, for instance, you've probably all seen the statues of Kuan Yin, often called the Chinese goddess of mercy. It's a Buddhist representation of the compassion of the infinite. And so for the spiritual love, and so for wisdom, and so for all sorts of other aspects, that's where all that statuary comes from. One final word of advice, and that is, having described this place, if you will, of the one can experience, it doesn't work to practice Buddhism in order to get that experience, because that's just another attachment. That's a faster horse. This enlightenment, if you want to call it that, remember, for the Buddha himself, was a side effect. It wasn't what he was after. He was after truth. He was after truth and meaning and why, and there's got to be more to life than greed and fear. He found this other thing, but he didn't set out to get it because he didn't know it existed. Now, greed for that can get one started in this particular path. It really does, particularly in the West, because we sort of work that way. But ultimately, that too must be given up. All things, all attachments, even the desire for enlightenment itself, and the desire for truth, and the desire for meaning, ultimately, are given up. So, is this a religion? I don't know. You tell me. I'm a priest of it. You tell me if this is a religion or not. There is faith, there is trust, there is belief. But often it comes not at the beginning, but at the end. There are moral and ethical codes, but there's no lawgiver, there's no sin, there's no punishment. It's just natural consequences. There is a continuity after death, but it's a continuity of the consequences of our actions, not of a self. There is that which is unborn and undying and totally pure. But it's the flow of the universe itself. Now, is that a god? I don't know. I have fun conversations with Christian theologians from time to time, and I'm now going to butcher another religion's ways of thinking by oversimplification. What they tell me that I have found useful is that, as opposed to the Sunday school God, that the theological school God can be described in terms of God the transcendent and God the immanent. And I hope I've got this right, but if I understand it correctly, the concept of God the transcendent is the God which is beyond, okay? The God which is the creator, the lawgiver, the God from which all flows, the God that is in glory in heaven and that loves us all. The God, the immanent, is the God or godliness in each blade of grass. The God that you see, if you look with the eyes of faith, in every single person, in the eyes of every other person. The God, as it were, in all things, at all times. Now the first, the God the transcendent, isn't really much like what we've got. We don't seem to have that sort of a God. The God, the immanent, is a lot more like what we've got. So can you have a God that is immanent but not transcendent? Well, I don't know. I'll leave that to the theologians to discuss. And does it really matter? To me, as you can tell, it doesn't. To me, this Buddhism stuff, whatever it may be, is simply one more viable alternative for some folks, and not for others, in our human search for peace, truth,
Mm-hmm.